gathered tonight the latest details on the Danilov case. After more than a month of detention in the Soviet Union, it appears as though U.S. reporter Nicholas Danilov is coming home. Also, film critic Bob Mondello reviews Children of a Lesser God. That's tonight at 5 on All Things Considered, followed at 6:29 by 91 Report, our regional news magazine. Well, with me in the studio now is singer Bobby McFerrin, who's in Philadelphia to perform this evening at the Chestnut Cabaret. Before we meet him, let's hear a selection from his new album, Spontaneous Invention, and this is the Lennon-McCartney song, From Me to You.
If there's anything that you want, if there's anything I can do, just call on me and I'll send it along with love from me to you. I got everything that you want, like a love that's so, so true. Just call on me and I'll send it along with love from me to you. I got arms that long to hold you and keep you by my side. I've got lips that long to kiss you and keep you satisfied. Ooh, if there's anything that you want, if there's anything I can do, just call on me and I'll send it along with love from me to you. Send it along, we love from me to you. We love from me to you. We love from me to you.
That's virtuoso singer Bobby McFerrin, who's my guest in the studio. His voice is so versatile that he can sing a solo doo-wop song, providing both the falsetto and bass lines. His voice can fool you into thinking you're hearing a muted trumpet. His repertoire includes pop, soul, and jazz classics, as well as original songs. Philadelphia Inquirer jazz critic Francis Davis called him the most astonishing jazz singer to come along since Betty Carter. McFerrin has two solo voice records, The Voice and his new album, Spontaneous Invention, which we just heard an excerpt of. He also received a Grammy for his performance on a track of the Manhattan Transfer album, Vocalese, and he's featured on the soundtrack of the new film, Round Midnight. McFerrin's parents are both opera singers. His father, baritone Robert McFerrin, sang with New York's Metropolitan Opera in the 50s, and he dubbed Sidney Poitier's singing voice in the film Porgy and Bess. McFerrin's mother, Sarah McFerrin, chairs the voice department at Fullerton College in Southern California. Bobby McFerrin didn't start singing until 1977 when he was 27. He started his career as a pianist, playing in a variety of settings from lounge bands to dance companies and even the Ice Follies. He's in Philadelphia to perform tonight at the Chestnut Cabaret. There's only one set tonight, and that's at 9 o'clock. The doors open at 8. The Chestnut Cabaret is at 38th and Chestnut Streets. For more information, you can call 896-6420. That's 896-6420. Bobby McFerrin, welcome to Fresh Air. It's really a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let's talk about a couple of technical things about your voice first, because I think people who hear you for the first time are just kind of overwhelmed at what you're capable of. How big is your range?
3.5 octaves. And sometimes, depending on what happens, sometimes I can kick into maybe 4 octaves or something. You know, it depends.
Did you stretch it? Is it naturally that large?
I worked on a little bit of it. I don't think it was always 3.5 octaves. I think that when I first started singing, it could have been 2.5 to 3. But I used to smoke a lot. And I think that when I started singing, I was so conscious of that I stopped and I was thinking about my diet and things like that. And I noticed, I think within 2 months or so, that my range increased maybe a major third or so. And then I noticed that also on the lower octaves, I had to work down to an E flat. I don't think that I could really sing that low yet, but I worked on that. So there were some parts of my range that I did have to work on.
What do you do to make your voice go lower than it's ever gone before? Stretch your range?
Well, you just think in terms of half steps. I think that my goal wasn't the E flat immediately, but maybe, you know, a G and G flat and an F, you know, and sort of working my way down a little bit at a time. And I would just try and visualize these notes and to think low, you know. But I think that now my range, 3.5 octaves, is pretty much set.
You are able to switch in the middle of a song, almost in the middle of a breath, from falsetto to bass line, back and forth like that. Mm. How do you do it? Do you have to think a certain way to get your voice to make that kind of abrupt switch?
Oh, actually, no. It's like it's advanced yodeling is about the best way I can describe it. It's pretty easy to explain. I'm not too sure if women can do this, because usually women sing soprano and alto, and their voices tend to be pretty high anyway. But perhaps some of the you know, contraltos might be able to do this if they can distinguish between their head voice and their chest voice. I'm speaking in my chest voice for those who don't understand. And then I switch to my head voice, which is this voice. So it's a matter of switching these two voices.
That's great. Do you have to learn how to breathe in order to get enough breath to do the different roles that you do when you're singing a song? Because you sing all the parts when you do a song.
Well, what's important is learning how to breathe musically and incorporating the breath in the music so that it doesn't sound that the breath is disrupting the melodic flow in any way. And that was something that I had to learn, because I used to do these pieces and then I would have to gasp for breath and it always would get in the way, you know, it would disrupt the flow. So I taught myself how to intone as I was inhaling and then to use the breath in certain parts of a piece so that it sounds like it's just one, it's something that belongs there, you know, maybe like a hi-hat or something, you know.
How can you intone as you inhale?
Well, in Blackbird, I do that. If you could tell where I took a breath, there it is, right?
Right. Now, you use your body as percussion sometimes, and it changes the timbre of your voice, too.
Well, actually, it just gives it a little kick. I wasn't always doing this. I play on my chest a lot, and I make these sounds. But there was a time when I didn't do that, and I always felt that there was something missing. And I would notice that whenever I was around a percussionist, the song was playing, I felt elevated somehow. And so I think accidentally one night I started playing on my chest, and I've been doing it pretty much since.
Is there a good bone to hit in order to get the sound that you like?
Well, I pretty much stay up here, which is, I don't know.
Is it the breastbone?
Maybe you could call it the breastbone, yeah. I don't know what you call it. But then sometimes I slap my stomach, because that's got a nice little slap to it. And then sometimes I play on my thighs, you know. I play my thighs.
Do you have perfect pitch?
Imperfect.
It is imperfect?
No, it's pretty good, but it's not perfect pitch.
I would have thought that you had always sung, because your voice just seems like a voice that has always been singing. But you really didn't start to sing till, what, you were 27 or something?
Well, no, I became a singer when I was 27. I had been singing around the house, but I didn't consider myself a singer, and there's a big difference. I sang in church choirs when I was a kid, and I would sing some background in some show bands that I used to work with and, you know, travel on the road playing a piano player. And they'd say, okay, now we're going to feature our keyboard player, Bobby Mack, and he's going to sing You Are the Sunshine of My Life or something like that, you know. So I would do a song or two a night, and then I'd be responsible for singing background parts, which I really never felt that I was good at, and I really detested singing background parts.
Why?
They just weren't fun, and usually I would have to sing in a range that I wasn't comfortable in, and I wanted to concentrate on my piano playing, and I couldn't concentrate on piano playing and singing simultaneously, you know.
Bobby Mack's a great name for
that was the name I used for many years, yeah.
Why did you switch from piano to voice?
I was dissatisfied with piano. I didn't feel like it was fulfilling all my needs creatively. And I couldn't get the piano to do the things that I heard, you know, like bending notes. you know.
You wanted to go like between the keys, yeah, and
right.
you couldn't get
and
in.
And I couldn't really do that. And I didn't feel that I always had a feeling in the back of my mind that piano really wasn't it.
And was there a big turning point or?
Well, I was working with, the turning point was when I became a singer in 77. And up until that point, I was still playing piano and I was working with dancers and writing some music for a repertory dance theater in Utah. And I was an accompanist for the University of Utah Dance Department. And I was really getting burnt out on that. And I wanted to do something else. And so I was asking myself this question, what do I do now? And I was asking it every day for weeks when I was struck by lightning on that particular day and heeded my inner voice and became a singer.
Did you know offhand what you wanted to sing? What kind of singer you wanted to be?
No, that was the next process. And I went through all kinds of visualizations and fantasies about what kind of singer I thought I could be. And as a piano player and playing piano bars and singing, you know, in some hotel lounges and things, I played a lot of ballads. And I thought that I could be, you know, a balladeer, another Johnny Hartman or something, you know, with wearing a white suit and a red carnation on my lapel or something like that. I thought I could do that. And I really thought that that's what I was going to do when the image of solo voice came up one day. And I thought it was a fascinating idea. You know, because I had been pretty much taken in by Keith Jarrett's solo, you know, work as a pianist, and I really loved a cappella music and the sort of the lone musician on stage.
It's really funny in a way to think of someone who's a pianist giving up the piano to do solo voice.
I didn't immediately give up the piano and do solo voice. It was it took me about a year and a half to really know that I wanted to get away from the piano and then concentrate on my voice. And at that point, I started looking around for bands to work with and just to see what it was like to be a singer and, you know, fronting a group. So I had to learn a whole new way of singing, you know, getting away from the piano where you're sitting down, you're comfortable, you don't have to do anything, and then standing in front of a band, you know, where you've got your body, and I didn't know what to do with my body for a long time. So I went from that and then really started thinking about solo voice and so I went from the piano bars to the band to the solo voice stuff.
Let's play something from your new solo voice album, and which has a couple of tracks that aren't solo voice. And this is from the album Spontaneous Invention. We're going to hear one of your own songs, Caramia. Mm-hmm. Would you say something about writing this or about what you're doing with your voice on it?
Well, it actually came up at that moment. I've done it that one time, and that was it.
Oh.
You know, it was a spontaneously invented piece.
Okay. Let's hear it. This is my guest, Bobby McFerrin. Do we feel
human bête. Tout à l'heure, oui, bien, c'est moi. Il est de mouvel n'engueque. T'es d'un rubika homo. Maintenant, on me sait les le. T'es le moment à hété. T'es de rubiku.
Bobby McFerrin from his new album, Spontaneous Invention. And Bobby McFerrin's in Philadelphia to perform this evening at the Chestnut Cabaret at 38th and Chestnut Streets. And I just realized it's really plural at Spontaneous Inventions.
Tons, yes.
And that was Bobby McFerrin's solo voice and Stool. That was the stool right. You were playing. When you started to sing, did you realize the things that your voice was capable of?
Not right away. I was suspicious of it, though, because I can remember taking vocal solos on albums that I would play around the house. And but not until I became a singer, I had the vision, I said, okay, now this is what I'm going to do. I had to rediscover the things that I already knew, you know. And so it took some time, you know, working on some sounds and the range. You know, not only the vertical range, you know, from the lowest note to the highest note, but then the horizontal range too. You know, the how your voice can expand. You know, the color range, stuff like that. So I had to rediscover those things because I was thinking about doing solo voice, and so I was aware that I had to throw everything, as much stuff as possible into my performances. I had to use everything that I had, you know.
Did you draw on some things that you had done as a child, just sitting around doing voices to yourself?
Probably. I think they were probably always there, but I was aware of doing it. For example, like, there's this bicycle horn that I've been making for years and years and years, and I've been asking some old friends, well, was I doing this, you know, when we were hanging out together? And I'm sort of getting an idea how long I'd been doing certain sounds, you know. But I'm really not aware of when I started doing a lot of these things, but hey.
Did you realize the capabilities that you had for imitating other sounds as part of your vocal range?
Well, you know, I never really thought of it as imitating. It always, I never really thought of myself as an imitator or the capability I've had of imitating sounds. And that's not what I was doing, and I wasn't thinking of well, I'm going to try to imitate this sound or that sound, you know. And so I didn't do it from that standpoint.
Your parents are both opera singers, and coming from a non-operatic background, I could say that to a lot of children, there's something really ludicrous about opera because the voice is so big and
mm-hmm.
and formal,
right.
And different from the kind of pop music that I think most kids grow up with.
Yeah.
And I'd love to hear if it felt that way to you, since you grew up hearing it. So it probably didn't sound weird like it does to other people.
I was used to it. In fact, there was when I was growing up in New York. I think Texaco had a program. They used to sponsor opera in the 50s. And on Sunday afternoons at 2 o'clock on Channel 4, NBC, we used to sit around as a family and watch, you know, Madame Butterfly and Tosca, you know, and all these great operas, Rigoletto, you know, on television. And we looked forward to it. And you could follow the storyline. Even if you couldn't understand the language, you could sort of get the gist of what it was. Now that I'm an adult and I can look back, I could see that operas are basically, you know, soap opera extravaganzas. You know, there's always a woman who's in love with a guy who spurns her, and maybe he's in love with somebody else. And so she plots with an assassin to kill this guy or whatever. You know, there's all this stuff going on. And you can pretty much figure it out. It's always a romantic kind of, you know, Harlequin romance kind of a situation that goes on in operas. And I just thought it was fascinating, you know, as a kid, you know, seeing the costumes and the colors. And when I was 6 years old, we went to the Met for the first time. And they really do a good job. I mean, because they'll have windstorms and you can feel the wind in the audience and things. And wow, it was great.
Did you ever want to sing opera?
No. I never felt that I was an opera singer or had that capability.
Did you hear your parents warming up all the time?
Oh, yeah. They were singing around the house all the time. Oh, for sure. For sure.
Did you copy that because you heard it all the time?
Well, I would mimic it, and I do occasionally on my gigs at night. I'll do a piece of an opera, or make up an opera on the spot, you know, and that's from that background.
Did they ever want you to sing opera?
No.
What was the music you enjoyed that was your music when you were a kid?
Well, when I was a very, very small boy, 3-4 years old, my parents told me that I was hooked on Gershwin. And I used to play Rhapsody in Blue a lot. And that was one of my favorite pieces. And then I got hooked on Rachmaninoff when I was about 6, and Puccini and Verdi. And then, I'm trying to think here, is it 10 years old? I don't really. I think I started listening to Bill Haley and the Comets and Major Bond, who did The Quarter to Three. Wasn't that his name?
Oh, Gary U.S. Bonds.
Gary U.S. Bonds, right, yeah. Gary U.S. Bonds. And Mary Wells, you know, the Marvin Gaye, the early 60s stuff. And then I got into Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, and Sergio Mendes, Brazil 66. I even listened to Henry Mancini. And so there was all kinds of music, you know. Joe Williams, Billie Holiday, Dinah Washington, Etta Jones.
I want to play something that almost reminds me of what might be going through your head if your parents were practicing scales a lot. And I'm sure this has nothing to do with what the record is actually about. But I found myself thinking about it. And I'm thinking of Music Box from your first record, because there's a lot of almost scales in it. There's stuff that almost sounds like exercises in it. What was going through your mind when you sang it?
Well, I think when I started the piece and it began to sound like, you know, a classical piece, and I just followed it along. You know, part of the part of the magic, I think, of what I do for me personally is not only doing the piece, but having the piece done to you. So I think I had gotten myself right in the middle of the control and the surrender. I was walking down that fine line between the two. And I seem to have the memory that I was simply watching the piece go by, and this is what came out.
Well, this is Music Box, my guest Bobby McFerrin, from his first album, The Voice.
Do
Bobby McFerrin from his first solo voice album, The Voice. Bobby McFerrin is in the studio with me. He's in Philadelphia to perform this evening at the Chestnut Cabaret at 38th and Chestnut Streets. That was really beautiful.
Thanks.
You get so many what I like is that you get very beautiful and very raw tones out of your voice. You have this whole range of colors that you can,
it's essential.
You can call on.
It's essential. I don't think that if I was sitting in the audience that I could hear, listen to a singer sing the same way, you know, all night long. You know, it would get pretty old after a while, I think.
You know what I'd like to know? This gets back to opera again.
Okay.
But I was wondering if any of your friends, especially black friends,
mm-hmm.
Put down your parents for singing opera because it's not, quote, soulful. Do you know what I mean?
I wasn't aware.
And opera is always considered, you know, a very like white European
right.
form.
I wasn't anything that I was aware of as a kid. In fact, I think the fact that both my sister and I respected that so much that we might have carried that into, you know, our circle of friends, and they might have respected it, you know, through us because we had such a high respect for what, you know, my father and my mother were doing, you know, as singers. And somehow it made us feel special in a way. So I don't think that we were, you know, boo-hooed in any way because, you know, our parents were, you know, into opera and things like that.
Did your parents give you any problem for listening to pop or soul music?
Only if it was too loud. That was the whole problem was we used to just turn the record player up to 10, you know, just turn it up, you know, and my parents would say that's too loud. We had, both my sister and I played organ in bands, you know, when we were in high school, and the band rehearsals were inevitably at our house because we had a big house, you know. And so my parents would live through that, you know, with the thumping bass and the bass drum and everything, and it was okay as long as the volume was kept at a reasonable level.
Did you ever impersonate your favorite soul singers and stand in front of a mirror and do them,
them
with a record on?
As a kid, not soul singers, but I used to impersonate Johnny Mathis or Nat King Cole, who were a couple of my favorites. And occasionally, if I'm in the mood in a concert, I might try, you know, in the night, I might try and sing like them again. I haven't done them in a while, but it comes up.
I want to play your recording of I Feel Good, which is the James Brown song.
Ow! Good God! Get down!
You do this with some irony as well as love.
Yeah. You know, I'm learning as I do these more and more to just have fun, because you know when I did The Voice a couple of years ago, even as early as just 2.5 years ago, I was so serious. You know, my posture was from this is music, I want you to listen, and I would simply sit in a stool, and my attitude was, you know, let's be very, very quiet, and I'm just going to sing, and you listen to what I'm doing. But they never really came out that way, because I discovered as the night would wear on, you know, after about 90 minutes of solo singing, by the end of the night, you know, I was laughing, and having just a wonderful time. And at first, it used to upset me. I used to go backstage after the concert and say to myself, Bobby, that just didn't come out the way you wanted it to. You know, you should have gone left when you wanted to go right, or vice versa, whatever. And it just never came out right, you know. And I used to really get on myself because I thought that I didn't have the right attitude for doing solo voice. And I think it was because of the vast effect that Jared had on me. You know, you attend one of his concerts, you know, and you read, I was reading all about him, you know, the respect he demanded from his audiences, et cetera, et cetera. And I was carrying some of that into my concerts. And then I had to wake up to the fact that, you know, I was my own person and what I was doing was totally different. And even though he had a big influence on me, I was not Jared. You know, he was who he was and I was who I am. And I should just simply be myself as a solo performer. So I started getting wackier and sillier and just having a much better time with myself.
And singing James Brown material.
Yeah, and singing James Brown material, et cetera. Even though even way back then, you know, even doing James Brown, I still had this kind of serious attitude about it, you know. But now, shoot, I'm just out there to have a good time.
Let's hear I Feel Good from your first album.
Good, good.
And my guest is Bobby McFerrin.
I feel good. I knew that I would. I feel good. I knew that I would. So good. So good that I got you. I feel good. I knew that I would. So good, so good, but I got you.
Bobby McFerrin. Bobby McFerrin is my guest. He's in Philadelphia to perform this evening at the Chestnut Cabaret at 38th and Chestnut Streets in Philadelphia. Before we heard that, you said you would probably do it differently if you're doing it now because you've loosened up so much. What would be different?
It's hard to say. I think the attitude would just be a little bit different. I just remember just being a bit stiffer back then. You know, I wasn't really working with my body too much. And most of the, 90 minutes was spent sitting in a chair. But I think, you know, when I was doing this piece, it was probably towards the end of the concert. It could even been an encore or something, because I do believe that it was at the end of a concert. So by that time, I was a lot looser. You know, I had loosened up and stuff.
Do you feel possessed by James Brown when you're singing that at all? Do you think about him at all?
Well, no, but in some other pieces, I try and think of myself as a character. You know, if I want to get a certain kind of feeling across, I will think myself into a character. I will think of myself into being a woman, or think myself into being the wind, or the waves lapping on the shore or something. I'll try and get myself into that kind of consciousness, because that really helps me, you know. So doing James Brown, I don't really think about him, but I sort of get into him in a way.
Did you ever sing doo-wop, sing in doo-wop groups?
No.
Did you like that stuff at all?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. I like any kind of solo a cappella singing, street singing on the corner. You know, this brings up an idea that John Hendrickson and I had a few years ago. We talked about doing a concert which would be street corner singing, John Hendricks, myself, Al Jarreau. But he's so busy, you know, Al is so busy now. But it was an idea that we had a few years back.
You were playing piano for a while in a variety of settings, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of them was the Ice Follies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm stretching my imagination here to imagine you playing for the Ice Follies. What was that like?
Well, after about 2 months, the first year I was working with them, it got a bit boring because, you know, you play the same thing every show. And sometimes we'd play three shows in a day. If you can imagine that. And so it would be the same show over and over and over again. And I think I got to the point where I dreamt the entire show one night. And I was working with some very good musicians, Paul Breslund and John Friesen on drums. We carried bass, drums, lead trumpet, and the conductor. And I played the keyboards, organ, and piano, and synthesizer. And the first year we did the show, we were all turned on to Sly Stone's album, I can't remember the name of it, but we were really into Sly Stone and what he was doing. And so we started playing some of the tunes as if Sly would play them. So we would mess the tunes up. We would just try new stuff with them all the time. And we had to do that because, excuse me, otherwise we would just lose our minds with boredom. So we would try different things with pieces and do our best to make each other laugh. You know, and sometimes we would throw things to each other back and forth on the bandstand, you know, just to loosen up a little bit. Because we're talking about 10 months out of 12 playing 400 and something shows in a year.
Are you glad you had some more showbiz type experience before going along your more artistic solo career?
Well, actually, yeah, I'm very happy that I was involved in theater for a while, because I see myself headed back into theater or being very theatrical, or you might call it voice theater, you know, because I've been thinking about writing some, I guess you could call them operas for the theater, you know, with voices and some lighting and movement. Since opera is being redefined nowadays by people like, you know, Phil Glass. And so anyway, I've been thinking about heading back into the theater. I would like to do some theatrical type projects, and I think that what I'm doing now is I'm sort of bringing some theatrical things into my performances. I'm inviting the audience to bring their own ideas to the concerts and to talk with me and to suggest things, and let's improvise together. You know, I like to open that up.
The kind of singing that you do is really, there's no one to compare it to, so it's not like people can, oh, market you like they did, blah, 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 or
right.
Produce your record like so-and-so's.
Yeah.
Was it hard to establish yourself when you started doing the solo voice performances? Because there was no other person you could really describe yourself in terms of.
Yeah, we're still trying to do that, too. I have a hard time trying to describe what I do. But the hardest part was, believe it or not, I even had a hard time with it. I had to work on convincing myself that I could actually do this and that it was a viable way for me to make a living. Then I felt that I had to convince my wife and my manager that this was a viable way for me to make a living. Then I had to convince the record company that I could do this. So I had a lot of convincing to do. And I'm sure, as I look back on it now, that my wife and Linda both felt that, you know, they believed in me strongly enough that they knew I could carry it off. But for some reason, you know, when you have inner doubts, you think that everybody doubts you and you can't really do this. So I worked on that for a couple of years. I had to get the confidence in myself. And it took a couple of years for me to do this.
What were the doubts that you were wrestling with?
Well, that it just wasn't going to be successful. You know, I'd go out there and fall flat on my face, and then everybody would say, see, I told you so, nobody's going to listen to solo voice for more than 10 minutes.
Did you ever have an experience like that where you could feel the audience, that you were losing them?
Well, the closest thing that I've come to that is doing a piece and feeling that it was the wrong piece to do. But that's been about it.
So you end it quickly and find the right one?
Or I just inject something else into it. You know, I change the piece some kind of way, or go into another piece, you know, or just stop. Occasionally, I've started a piece, and I just stopped the piece, and I tell the audience, well, I don't want to do this piece right now, and since I'm on stage by myself, I can do whatever I want, so I'm going to stop, you know. And then I'll try something else.
You have a track on the Vocalese record of Manhattan Transfers and got a Grammy Award for that, and I think that track is also on your new record.
Mm-hmm, right.
That strikes me as being a more conventional setting for your voice. Did you enjoy?
Oh, I enjoyed that,
kind of
that a lot, because it was giving me an opportunity to collaborate with the Transfer. And the Transfer and I have known each other for about 6 years now. And when they approached me with this project, you know, to do Another Night in Tunisia, my first reaction was, "Oh, you want to do this song again, Another Night in Tunisia?" But then when Cheryl and I would get together with my four-track Fostex machine and try and figure out what to do. Basically, what we did, we went to the studio with just these scraps of ideas and came up with this arrangement. And it was fun just to work with them that way because, you know, they're used to having everything written down and they know exactly what they're going to do and they sing it over and over and over again and they record it. And this was new for them because they had to really rely on trust. I mean, you really have to trust when you're improvising, you know, the things are going to work out okay. And so we would just find these parts and then we just pieced them together in the studio.
We were talking about establishing your career and, you know, getting started doing something as distinctive as you do. Once you realized you were going to do solo voice performance, is that another sound you're capable of? Stomach growling.
There you go. It's dinner time, folks.
Okay. Once you figured out some of the things your voice was capable of, were there things that you realized you didn't want to do with it that would be of novelty interest, but nothing greater than that? Because you could, like you say, you don't like to think of yourself as imitating a trumpet.
Right.
But you could do all kinds of novelty things if you wanted to, and you could walking around just imitating a band. And
I could.
Doing stuff like that.
I could. And it's beginning to bother me less and less that people, you know, think that I'm an imitator, you know, and that's what I'm trying to do. You know, if they come to my concerts, maybe they'll get the point after that. I don't really think about it that much, you know, anymore. But if talking about novelty things, the one thing that I wouldn't want to do is, you know, people have said, why don't you go into the studio and do something on 16 tracks, you know, overdub your voice over and over and over again. And that's the antithesis of what I'm doing now, is trying to suggest all those things. So it would just seem like it would be taking something away if I should go into the studio and just lay another one track down, two tracks. However, since I'm very good at contradicting myself, just yesterday, I was talking with Linda about doing something like this, but having a very popular singer, you know, a pop singer of note, you know, whether it's Chaka Khan or Steve Perry from Journey or, you know, Phil Collins from Genesis, you know, or Lionel Richie, and then doing all the parts, all the background parts for them.
Why would you want to record with a big name like that?
Well, you know, it's just an idea. You know, I think since I'm a soloist, I can lend myself to different situations. So, okay.
No.
Okay. So it's just something that I'm trying to think of as many different things as possible, as many ideas, and I think they're all a go. You know, if you've ever attended any brainstorming sessions, all ideas, you put your ideas out on the table with no judgmental, you know, well, this won't work, and what you don't get into that. You just put them down, you know.
While we're kind of on the subject of your uncanny ability to sound like instruments when you want to, I thought we could just play an excerpt of something you just recorded for the soundtrack of the film Round Midnight.
Circular Midnight, the way it's written on the cover.
Right? Yeah, you're concerned that there's no apostrophe.
There's no apostrophe even before the R. The R should be a small case R.
I'm sure our listeners are just up right. in arms hearing yeah. about this.
Yes.
Anyways, why don't we hear just an excerpt of that, of Round Midnight. And this is from the cast recording. The cast recording, making it sound like it's a Broadway show.
Right.
Of the soundtrack of the film that's about to be released, called Round Midnight, which stars Dexter Gordon. And this is Bobby McFerrin on voice, sounding disarmingly like a trumpet.
There it is. There you go.
You really did sound like a trumpet on it. Was that why did they get you to do that? Were you supposed to?
Well, no, I wasn't supposed to. But when we rehearsed the piece, you know, before we recorded, you know, putting it down on tape, it just had that kind of a mood. You know, it was very blue. And I was trying to come up with just a blue kind of a sound.
Did they say, McFerrin, can you do Miles Davis for us on Round Midnight?
No, I've heard that, though. People have been saying, hey, you know, I thought that was Miles, man, and who was doing that. And I was really shocked, man, because it sounds so much like Miles. And I said, well, no, I wasn't trying to do that. You know, I just had this kind of personality. I was just trying to get into a personality of the piece. And so I just shaded my voice in a certain way. You know, you know, it's really funny because I think sometimes I'm not sure if I'm trying to do something or not. You know, and it'd be really easy for me to say, well, I wasn't trying to do that. And then I'll think to myself, well, maybe I was. You know, I never really know for sure.
Well, some singers say as if it's the ultimate tribute to the voice that they want to sound like they're a horn.
Oh, yeah, but I don't believe that. For me, it's the opposite, I think, because I think the voice has so much more. It's a supreme instrument. It's the best. You can sound like anything. A good example. Do you know Bob Gerland in New York?
No.
I mean, this guy is known as the human trumpet. You know, if you want to, you could say he sounds exactly like one, you know. And so I have two feelings about that. One, it simply shows the supremacy of the voice, that it can just do anything, you know. And two is, in a way, it sort of takes, if you can see my point, it sort of takes away of the, I guess people see it in a sense, they're thinking that, boy, sometimes I get lost. You know, my brain's working faster, or it can't take in all this information. But the first point was the voice can do anything. The second point is it sort of demeans the voice. It takes something away from it by trying to imitate something else. You know, it's like going further away from the voice. You know what I mean? So it's like it's doing two things simultaneously. It's going towards the voice and it's going away from the voice. And I never can really figure out what I'm doing sometimes. You know?
One of the things that a voice can do that no instrument can is tell a story through lyrics. You sometimes do lyrics and you sometimes do wordless songs. Do you like having a lyric so that you can... You talked before about how singing is sometimes almost like acting for you.
Right.
You know, you're imagining dramatic situations almost. Yeah. You're imagining characters for you to be.
Yeah. Well, I like wordless singing more. For one thing, it's not as difficult to sing. You know, if you sing something with words, then it's more difficult to sing some of the high notes and to move around in as easily, you know, if you've got all these consonants getting in the way, you know. And another thing about wordless singing, which I prefer, is then one song that I'm singing can become hundreds of songs, depending on how what I'm singing affects the listener. If I should say something like, baby, 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 I love you, I love you, I love you, then everybody has the same experience. But if I... You know, then what is that? I mean, that's one song for me. It's another song for somebody else, you know.
Now that you're doing so much singing on record and in performance, do you have to be concerned about hurting your voice with what you're doing? I know a lot of singers see specialists who mm-hmm. teach them new ways to sing and to breathe so that they don't hurt their vocal cords.
Well, no, I don't worry about that because I sing very softly. I don't sing too much louder than this, you know, this volume. My technique is very soft, so I never really push, so I'm not afraid of hurting myself. In the 3 or 4 years that I've been traveling solo, I've only had to cancel one performance, and that's because I got laryngitis one day. I just woke up and I just, and maybe it was just a severe cold or something, but I just had all this phlegm and stuff, and I just couldn't sing more than an octave, you know, and that was it.
Do you do a lot of warm-up exercises to get your voice flexible before a performance?
Well, I don't walk out on stage cold. Yeah, that's not a good idea. But I basically just sing a lot during the day, you know. And when I'm backstage a few minutes before I go on, I'll sing a piece or two or something.
Have you ever asked your parents for advice on how to keep the voice in good shape? I figure
at the beginning, yeah. When you know, 9 years ago, when I started on this venture, I went right to my parents and asked for some vocalese, you know, some exercises to do. And they basically said, you know, that there's a lot of stuff that you already know, and you can find some exercises yourself. I mean, they gave me some things to do.
What are the good exercises for you?
Well, sometimes I practice tenths. I'll do some things like that, or I'll just, you know, just sing something. I don't think of exercises. If I think of exercises and practicing and stuff like that, you know, that whole... if I get into that whole mindset about how I feel about those words, then I probably wouldn't do anything. So I just sing songs.
How do you feel about standards, you know, songs? Like on your new album, you sing I Hear Music, the Frank Lesser song.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't seem to do a lot of standards on your records.
No, and it's not because I don't like them or appreciate them. It's just that they just don't come up. If the audience who comes to the concert tonight... If they all suggested standards, they say, do this and do that, I might do a lot of standards tonight, you know. So it's just that I don't think I know a lot of standards.
You know, one thing that our listeners might know you for also, which we haven't mentioned, is your 501 Jeans commercial. How did that happen?
I got a phone call one day from, God, I can't remember the guy's name. Linda. What's his name? She can't hear me. But anyway, that's okay. And he said, yeah, I'm doing the 501 Levi's series, and you can go into the studio and do whatever you want. And so initially I went to the studio for about an hour and laid down some ideas, and they were close, but not the cigar. And Linda had the intuition of as she was bringing them this tape, of also taking another tune that I had done called Drive, which... I'm gonna get in my car, which turned out to be the Levi's Blues commercial. I said, well, we like this. We really like this. Just put some lyrics to it. Got my 501 Blues, Levi's, you know.
Well, I think what everybody hopes who does a commercial is that the commercial's exposure will introduce new listeners to the records of the performer. Does it work that way?
I have really no way of knowing, but I hope that's what happens. You know, I hope they listen to the commercial and say, well, what is that? And maybe somebody that's, you know, happens to be there says, well, that sounds like Bobby McFerrin, you know, so well, you should go check out his albums.
Okay. Well, Bobby McFerrin, I really have to thank you for being here. It's really been a great pleasure to meet you.
Thanks a lot.
And Bobby McFerrin is going to perform this evening at the Chestnut Cabaret at 38th and Chestnut Streets. If you want to hear more of his records, he has two solo voice albums. The latest is called Spontaneous Inventions, and it's on the Blue Note label. And his earlier record is called The Voice, and that was on Elektra Musician. He's also featured on the new soundtrack recording of the new film Round Midnight. Well, we're going to close with a selection from the last selection, the closing selection of Bobby McFerrin's new album, Spontaneous Inventions. This is his own piece, Mañana Iguana.
Mañana Iguana.
This is Mañana Iguana.
Mañana Iguana.
Well, why don't you cue it up then? We're going to listen to it. It's on Spontaneous Inventions. Side two, last cut.
Mañana Iguana.
So long, farewell, auf Wiedersehen, good night. So long, farewell, auf Wiedersehen, good night.
Is it queued up yet?
It's queued.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Bobby McFerrin.
You're welcome.
I'm gonna say bye-bye. I'm gonna say bye-bye. I'm gonna call it quits so I can sing later on. So I'm gonna call it quits. I'm gonna say bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Brown cow, till then, penguin, mañana, iguana. Drive safely, walk safely, speak safely, think safely, eat
Bobby McFerrin from his new album, Spontaneous Inventions. Well, before we check in with Shadow Traffic, I want to let you know that severe thunderstorm watch has been issued by the National Storms Forecast Center, and the thunderstorm watch is in effect until 10 o'clock this evening. Well, let's check in now with Shadow Traffic.
Well, good afternoon. Pretty heavy traffic on northbound 95 this afternoon. It's jammed from approaching Academy through approaching Woodhaven because of an accident off to the side there. And the Schuylkill Expressway, if anything, is even worse. Eastbound jammed from Gulf Mills to 476, again from Gladwin to City Avenue. And eastbound westbound now, a 25-minute delay from west of Montgomery in through Belmont. Eastbound Walt Whitman Bridge, slow approaching the tolls to midspan because of an earlier disabled vehicle. And southbound 42, slow from the Walt Whitman all the way down to 55. That's Shadow Traffic. I'm Randy Chepigan on 91 FM WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Superfresh. Again, there is a severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 10 o'clock this evening. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, We'll be joined by several high school teachers who will give us an inside look at the Philadelphia high schools and some of the problems and some of the strong points of teaching at Philadelphia high schools. That's tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. Also coming up this week at 4 o'clock on Wednesday, Mark Litwack will be my guest, author of Real Power, and it's about the politics and power of the Hollywood film industry. Friday afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, my guest will be New York Times book critic Christopher Lehmanhaupt. We'll talk about book reviews and also about his new book, Me and DiMaggio. And this Sunday at 6 on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be crime writer George V. Higgins, so I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's show. Joyce Lieberman and Dan Lachlan, the engineers, assistance from Marty Moss Cohen. Amy Salad is the associate producer, Danny Miller and I, the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a very good evening. Let WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered. It's 5 o'clock.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Margo Adler.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
A Lufthansa airline liner left Moscow, bound for Frankfurt, West Germany, and on board are Mr. and Mrs. Nicholas Daniloff.
To a cheering crowd in Kansas City, President Reagan announces that journalist Nicholas Daniloff has been released. Tonight on All Things Considered, Daniloff leaves the Soviet Union and arrives in Frankfurt.
Also tonight, we learn of Daniloff's departure from Moscow and how the arrangement was made.
In Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, three bomb explosions destroy the peace of a small city.
In Italy, religious leaders rethink their attitude toward nature at the World Wildlife Fund's 25th anniversary.
Also physics and philosophy.